The most beautiful word in the dictionary to me is
perfection. Perfection Auto Works. Can I help you? I can't believe it. Shyster's Auto took you for $900, and now you have a car fire. They're a bunch of criminals.
Criminals. We have to get the criminals out of our country. A mass deportation.
Jeff, it's a war zone out there. When it comes to auto repair, you gotta be careful.
I will not send you to fight and die in a foolish, never-ending foreign war.
Look, I'm here to save you money, so you've got more money for the family.
It'll also bring your grocery bill way down.
You really have a great car here. You know, with the right repairs from Perfection Auto Works, your car could be as good as gold.
This will truly be the golden age of America, because together we can truly make America great again. We're going to turn it around.
Let Perfection Auto Works make your car great again. Call today, 323-8650 and perfectionautoworks.com.
This is America's Fabric, a program about the cultural beliefs and foundations of our exceptional country. The program you're about to hear will help connect those beliefs and foundations to today's society. The program is paid for by the America's Fabric Organization, funded by individual sponsorship. Here is your host for today's program.
Lear Sapir is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, where he's been following the massive increase in children identifying as transgender and undergoing what's known as gender-affirming care treatment, from puberty blockers to double mastectomies. His current area of focus is the pushback to gender interventions for minors, including state bans, lawsuits, and a landmark case now at the Supreme Court. And I'm Yanya Kellick.
Lear Sapir, such a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Tennessee has banned walk away from this case and let that Tennessee law stand. You're arguing against that, though.
That's right. So the Trump DOJ could, in theory, back away from the case and drop it. And I argue that they shouldn't do that. I think the facts of the case, and more importantly, the arguments of the case, are heavily on the side of Tennessee, and a conservative majority court is likely to rule in favor of Tennessee. And this case has tremendous consequences for what's going to happen in the 26 states that have banned these interventions in minors.
Maybe tell me a little bit how you've come into being an expert on this question.
I wrote a dissertation on Title IX, the federal law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in education, and I wrote on how the Obama administration and the federal courts had changed the meaning of Title IX to require schools to defer to students according to their gender identity, the way in which they self-identified as male or female. And what I started to notice during my postdoc year is that the arguments being made by advocacy groups like the ACLU were medical. These were medical arguments citing medical professionals, medical associations, and medical literature. And so I started looking at that literature. And once you look, you can't look away. Because the reality of the situation is that these interventions, including social transition in school, are said to be based on credible science, credible research over the years, and there just isn't that kind of evidence to support it. And I found it fascinating that consensus has formed around these types of interventions, psychological as well as physical, in the absence of any credible evidence. School personnel and advocacy organizations believe, sometimes sincerely, that they are just following the best practices as announced by the medical community.
It can be very difficult for people to believe that the entire medical community, or maybe not the entire, but the decision makers in the medical community have adopted something that you're suggesting actually doesn't have a basis in medical evidence.
That's right. And that's usually the first hang up when you talk to people who know maybe a little bit about this topic. They'll say something like, look, you know, this is the consensus of medical authorities. And by medical authorities, they mean professional medical associations, the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Endocrine Society, and so on and so forth. First of all, if the standard is consensus of medical associations or medical bodies, there is no consensus even by that standard, because numerous European countries, health authorities in several European countries, after conducting systematic reviews of evidence, have backed away from these treatments, recognizing that, in fact, they lack credible evidence of benefits, and they have a real potential to do harm. So there's no consensus regardless. Even if you look only at the United States, the medical associations don't all march in lockstep on this issue. For example, last year, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons broke with the consensus and said, we recognize that there's really no good evidence for this in minors. The more important point, of course, is that consensus-based medicine is not the same as evidence-based medicine. Mm. That is a very important distinction. And in fact, the field of evidence-based medicine, which came into its own during the 1990s, was created precisely in order to create this distinction between what doctors say is good treatment and what the evidence actually supports. You have to recognize, you have to acknowledge that, yes, there is a kind of a pseudo-consensus, and I'll say it in a minute why it's a pseudo-consensus. But that doesn't mean that these are evidence-based treatments. That just means that medical groups say they are. If you actually look at how these treatments ascended to the level of a consensus among medical associations, first of all, these are professional trade unions. It's important to recognize that. They exist to protect and promote the interests of doctors, first and foremost. But more importantly, in this case, they have oftentimes subcommittees that specialize in a certain area of care. So the American Academy of Pediatrics, for example, about a decade ago, convened a special working subgroup on LGBTQ health and appointed, I think it was 6 clinicians to that subgroup who were all kind of ideologically on board with gender transition treatments for kids. And the rest of the leadership of the AAP deferred to their colleagues in the specialized subcommittee on the assumption that they know what they're talking about, they're the experts in the field, and what do we know? And what you see, Jan, is that in a field as advanced in terms of scientific knowledge as medicine, where there is high levels of complexity and division of labor, you have to have that in order for these types of human endeavors to be possible. There's a great deal of trust and deference between medical professionals, and that trust can be and has been exploited. So that's kind of the backstory to how we got to the pseudo-consensus. You had the leadership of these medical associations said, look, we're not experts, but these people claim they are, so we're just going to defer to them.
There was a recent lawsuit in Alabama that in the process of discovery, they basically put into the discovery. As far as I'm aware, that is the most detailed compendium, up-to-date compendium of evidence that I'm aware of. And maybe you can speak to it. Yeah.
I mean, in a way, it's unfortunate that the case before the Supreme Court is the Tennessee ban. And one of the reasons the Biden administration decided to appeal that ban is precisely because the evidence record in that case is incomplete. Alabama case has by far the most complete evidence record. There's a good reason that the Biden administration decided not to appeal from there. I think the greatest mistake the gender industry in the United States ever made was to sue the state of Alabama over its ban on youth transition. The attorney general of the state of Alabama secured subpoenas from the judge in that case, Judge Lyle Burke, to have the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, whose standards of care version 8 control the entire medical field in this area in the United States, to subpoena all their internal emails related to the development of standards of care 8, SOC 8. And what those emails have revealed has been nothing short of shocking. Those emails contain the smoking gun evidence of medical scandal. And so here's what they found. WPATH commissioned systematic evidence reviews as part of the process of developing SOC 8. When it found out that the evidence reviews specifically for minors were unimpressive, did not get them the results that they wanted that would support their medical approach, they suppressed them. They basically instructed the researchers at Johns Hopkins University who were doing these systematic reviews to not publish them. And then they also claimed in SOC 8, systematic review of evidence for minors is not possible, even though they themselves had commissioned one and suppressed it. More than that, they also spoke to what they called in internal emails a social justice lawyer. And that lawyer told them, according to these emails, that having these types of systematic reviews would actually be bad for WPATH since it would compromise its ability to win lawsuits. And it would also place clinicians who provide these treatments at legal risk for malpractice. So it killed the evidence reviews and claimed that they're not possible. Beyond that, WPATH also, in a move that surprised a lot of us, a few days after it published SOC 8 in 2022, issued a correction in the medical journal in which SOC 8 came out, and it said, we're now eliminating all age minimums for medical interventions for kids with the exception of phalloplasty. So all surgeries, all hormones, puberty blockers, all none of that have any age minimums from now on. And it turns out that they did that not for any clinical reason or because of evidence, but they did that under pressure from Dr. Rachel Levin, who is the Assistant Secretary for Health in the Biden administration, who expressed concern that having specified age minimums in SOC 8 would draw political controversy. And it turns out the American Academy of Pediatrics, which told WPATH, we're not going to endorse this. In fact, we're going to actively oppose it if you specify age minimums. So you got to get rid of them. And, you know, we have other things that have come out of that discovery that are no less concerning. For example, the lead author of SOC 8 admitted in a deposition that both financial and intellectual conflicts of interest were simply overlooked in the process of recruiting people to work on SOC 8. In fact, having a conflict of interest was deemed to be a prerequisite to being on the SOC 8 committee, which is really shocking. It violates every tenet of how responsible guidelines should be. So what happened was, this came out of the deposition of Eli Coleman, the lead author of SOC 8, and also of Marcy Bowers, who was then the president of WPATH and also a co-author on SOC 8. Coleman was asked explicitly, were you aware that most of the people on the SOC 8 development committee had conflicts of interest? And he said yes. He was aware. And yet, if you look at the disclosure section, it says no conflicts of interest. Marcy Bowers said that being a proponent of the medical gender-affirming approach was a prerequisite to being invited to participate on the committee. So the WPATH leadership has admitted this under oath in a deposition. What do I mean by financial and intellectual conflicts of interest? A few of the developers of SOC 8 were expert witnesses in cases in which what SOC 8 would have said would determine whether their side in the lawsuit ends up winning. So they stand to gain financially from SOC 8 saying certain things and not others. Marcy Bowers, the president of WPATH, in a deposition admitted to making over $1 million in 2023 from performing gender surgeries. Most of the other clinicians on the SOC 8 development team also made money, had professional appointments, gained professional reputations from performing these procedures or at least endorsing them. And those are considered financial and, of course, intellectual conflicts of interest. If you become a public advocate, if you write in favor of a certain position, you're less likely to evaluate impartially the evidence base for a treatment. The key thing here is that the U.S. Institute of Medicine in 2011 announced standards for the development of what they called trustworthy medical guidelines. And WPATH claimed that they were following these standards. In fact, Eli Coleman himself claimed that those standards were controlling. But if you look at those standards, they clearly and explicitly say you cannot have people with conflicts of interest dominating the process of developing a medical guideline. Any way you look at it, WPATH greatly deviated from how responsible, trustworthy medical guidelines are supposed to be developed, and they suppressed this information and tried to conceal it from the public.
WPATH is the standard that a lot of these professional organizations have followed. But WPATH isn't per se a medical organization, as I understand it.
So how did WPATH rise to prominence? It's a situation in which you have a specialized group of clinicians and activists, and it's true that WPATH is, even though it calls itself the Professional Association for Transgender Health, it's an activist group made up of lots of disparate elements. Not all of them are doctors, mental health professionals. Some of them are journalists, run-of-the-mill activists. Some of them are social workers. But they have positioned themselves as the experts. And nobody really questions that in the medical field, although now they do. And certainly in Europe, the European countries completely reject WPATH. I think the director of Belgium's Center for Evidence-Based Medicine said he would throw WPATH's guidelines in the dustbin. So they're no fans of WPATH there. But here in the United States, they are de facto the authorities in the field. In the absence of other organizations issuing guidelines, and there's one exception, the Endocrine Society did issue a guideline, but in the absence of other organizations saying, no, we're going to issue our own guideline and take a different approach, WPATH has emerged as the de facto leader in the field.
WPATH did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
How is it that Europe has really looked more systematically at the evidence? How do you explain that exactly?
First of all, just so listeners are aware, the UK has now banned puberty blockers. Probably will ban cross-sex hormones, too, is my prediction in the next few years. Surgeries are almost never performed outside the United States. Extremely rare.
Lay out to me what this gender-affirming care approach is.
According to the standard protocol as developed in the Netherlands, as soon as a kid reaches 10 or stage 2 of puberty, which is kind of the early development of puberty, the first stage is puberty blockers, which block puberty from going into effect. Initially, these drugs were intended to provide a window of time for kids to figure out whether to continue with transition. Now we know, based on research, based on the expertise of clinicians involved in the field, that that is simply not the case, because almost 100% of kids who go on puberty blockers end up going on to cross-sex hormones. So blockers very likely lock in the gender distress that would otherwise, in most cases, evaporate.
So a kid shows up, has gender distress, not sure whether they're male, female, or something else.
Yeah.
And then the next step is,
according to the traditional protocol, they had to be quite sure that they are, in fact, the opposite sex. And so they would be given puberty blockers, time to figure it out. And almost all of them would, of course, figure out that, in fact, they're trans, they want to proceed. And so the next step is cross-sex hormones. Mm-hmm. So testosterone if you're a girl, estrogen if you're a boy. And whereas puberty blockers prevent the body from developing through its endogenous puberty process, cross-sex hormones are meant to induce the appearance of sex characteristics that mimic the opposite sex. So, you know, in girls who take testosterone, for example, their voice will get lowered, and that could actually be irreversible. And then the final stage, in the United States at least, surgeries. And for boys, this is much, much more rare, but for boys, it could involve a vaginoplasty, a surgical inversion of the penis, or if they went on puberty blockers and their penile tissue didn't develop, the surgeon will borrow tissue from the colon and create a kind of a semblance of a vagina with colon tissue. In Europe, these surgeries are usually only offered after age 18, but in the United States, they are offered to minors as well. There's deviations from it in the United States. Gender-affirming care is typically more a la carte. It's whatever the kid wants. Mm-hmm. So if they want just the cross-sex hormones, that's what they get. If they want just the surgery, that's what they get. Also, within the last 5-6 years, we've seen the rise of so-called non-binary procedures, which, unlike the Dutch protocol, the non-binary procedures are really just meant to allow kids to pursue whatever, as the clinicians call it, embodiment goals they want. So if they want a little bit of body hair and to also have breasts and all that kind of stuff, they can kind of mix and match their drugs and surgeries to produce idiosyncratic body types that are not found in nature.
So in Europe, in the UK, they banned puberty blockers. So that basically stops this whole process.
The UK and Finland and Sweden have recognized, based on systematic evidence reviews, that these treatments are fundamentally still experimental. Norway, Denmark has significantly scaled back. Medical authorities in Germany and France have issued stern warnings about these procedures in Italy. Why is it that these countries have managed to do this, whereas in the United States, things have gone totally off the rail, and there seems to be, other than political pushback through Republicans, there seems to be nothing to stop it. It's a complicated question. I think a large part of the answer has to do with how our health system works compared to their health system. In Finland or Sweden, these are government-run health systems. So the government pays for insurance, but also runs the hospitals. And what happens there is that government has a fiduciary responsibility to taxpayers to use finite resources in a responsible way to promote the health of the public. And that means that they have a strong incentive to make sure that they're allocating resources to treatments that are really evidence-based, that are effective. And so these countries have agencies. In Finland, it's called the Council for Choices on Healthcare. In Sweden, it's the SBU. In the UK, it's the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. These are these government agencies or public agencies that have the responsibility to evaluate impartially the evidence base for medical treatments. And every single agency in Europe that has done that has come to the exact same conclusion. There is no credible evidence that these treatments are safe and effective. In the United States, things are very different. We don't have universal government insurance. We have private insurance companies that can recoup their costs. Blue Cross or United Healthcare, whatever, pays for these interventions. They can just raise premiums across the board and recoup their costs without considerations of fiduciary obligation to taxpayers. More than that, because we as Americans have a kind of a healthy distrust of centralized power in government, medical policymaking is de facto done in the states, and even more de facto is controlled heavily by medical boards and professional associations, who are essentially trade unions that advocate on behalf of doctors and doctor interests. And so we have plenty of examples throughout American medical history of medical associations learning that the evidence doesn't support a certain treatment that their members perform and make money from, and yet opposing any effort to impose restrictions. A good example is arthroscopic knee surgery, where a double-blinded randomized control trial found that in the vast majority of people who get them, over 500,000 people get them every year, they're no better than what's called a sham surgery, meaning a placebo surgery. And yet, so CMS wanted to cut off a lot of these surgeries, and the association that is essentially the home of surgeons who perform these procedures, they said, no, sorry, we don't accept the findings of this systematic review. Please interpret it very narrowly and don't issue any correction to current practices. But the bottom line is we have this kind of highly decentralized healthcare system where the financial interests and professional interests of doctors, of medical associations, of drug companies have a very heavy role. We do, in fact, have agencies that are counterparts to the ones I mentioned in Europe. PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, the AHRQ, which sits within the HHS. And these are agencies tasked with assessing the evidence base for medical interventions. The problem is that in the wake of the Affordable Care Act being passed in 2010, Republicans neutered them. Republicans went to war with these agencies and basically said, in cooperation with medical associations and drug companies, simply said, we don't want these government agencies or you know, kind of publicly funded agencies to dictate healthcare decisions.
And probably not expecting this as an outcome.
The good example of the unintended consequences of policy decisions.
Another very systematic, detailed review of the evidence was this CAS review in the UK, which led to this outcome that you described.
That's right.
If someone is interested in understanding the body of actual evidence around these types of procedures, where's the best place someone could go to kind of dig deep a little bit and understand that?
Well, the CAS review is not a systematic review per se. It's a almost 400-page report based on a multi-year investigation of the UK's Gender Identity Development Service, which has since been discontinued, but it's based on seven new systematic reviews of evidence and guideline quality that were commissioned for the purpose of the review itself. In the UK, a few were done in Sweden and Finland. One was done by McMaster University in Canada, which is the home of evidence-based medicine, commissioned by Florida Healthcare Agency. Is there one place where all this appears? You know, you have to look for it. You have to know what you're looking for. The CAS review is a good place to start. It's a very long document. Unfortunately, it's written in the language of gender ideology. I think that was intentional to get buy-in from people on the other side of this issue. But it does discuss the evidence, the ethical problems, what we know, what we don't know, the clinical practices that have come into being in the last decade or so. And it creates a pretty damning picture. It's proven to be hugely transformative in this field. It has made it impossible for American medical groups and gender clinicians to continue pretending that anybody who disagrees with their radical approach is an ideologue who hates people who identify as transgender. I don't think anybody can take that argument seriously anymore.
There's been this huge issue in the last few years about parental rights, that parents should ultimately decide. But what if parents decide that this is a good course of treatment?
Yeah, it does present a certain dilemma. Those of us who have been trying to push back against this medical scandal, expose it, in the context of education in schools, we've been making arguments about parental rights. Schools should not perform social gender transition on kids behind parents' backs. There are serious consequences to that. Parents should be involved. Parents have a right to decide. But in the medical context, those who advocate for the gender-affirming care pathway are the ones claiming parental rights. They say states should not ban it. Let parents make the decision. These decisions should be between parents on behalf of their kids and doctors. Here's why I think that's wrong. I think it's wrong for a number of reasons. Parents don't have a right to dictate medical treatment. They have a right to choose from among the treatments that doctors can responsibly and ethically offer to them. The doctors have the primary responsibility to only offer treatments that are within the standard of care, that are evidence-based, and that are net beneficial, or at least reasonably assumed to be. So medicine is not consumerism. It's not as though a parent can walk into a clinic and say and just pick and choose whatever they want. The question of parental rights is it's logically secondary to the question of what doctors should be offering and why. But beyond that, if you actually have seen what happens in a gender clinic, if you've seen the consent forms, if you've spoken to people like Jamie Reed who have worked in these clinics, and I know that parents are almost never given the full unvarnished picture of what we know and what we don't know about these. Sometimes they're given a very incomplete story. Sometimes they're outright lied to. For example, we have numerous examples of parents being told by the gender clinician, sometimes in front of their own kid, that if the kid doesn't access these treatments, he or she will kill herself. There's no evidence that that's true, and in fact, it's a dangerous thing for a clinician to say, especially in front of a kid. Under those circumstances, what parent would not agree to these treatments? If the alternative is death, any risk is worth it. And then we also see many of these cases of parents disagreeing with each other. It's almost always the mom who wants to do it and the dad who is skeptical. Spoken to journalists who have interviewed many parents associated with particular clinics, and they've said, yeah, that's pretty much what we observe too. It's almost always the mom. What happens when the parents disagree? In Jamie Reed's clinic, the practice was you go at the parent who agrees and you lie to the parent who disagrees. You get them out of the picture as fast as you possibly can. I remember watching a training session, the Cleveland Clinic, where the gender clinicians there said, if the parents disagree, we just have to keep working with them until they agree. Even if you buy the parental rights argument and ignore the more important responsibility of clinicians not to offer these treatments in the first place, parents are very often lied to, misled, and bullied into submission in order to agree to these interventions. And once they agree, they cross a Rubicon. Once you agree to medical interventions that have irreversible consequences for your kids, including sterility, possible sexual dysfunction, cognitive impairment, it's very difficult for any parent to say, actually, this was the wrong thing for me to do. I harmed my kid. I've always been very against activists who are kind of pushing back against gender medicine, who want to demonize parents, who want to try to cast them as abusers of their own children. Because in the vast majority of cases, these parents were lied, misled, bullied. So we need to be able to provide them with off-ramps to recognize that this was not the right decision and to figure out a way back to restore their kids' health. There's no credible basis to believe that these are beneficial, and the risk of harm is real and substantial, and so therefore there's kind of a very compelling argument to stave off these interventions and let the kid mature, let them get psychotherapy, then figure things out. Most of these kids, or at least a lot of them, are gay and will realize that about themselves. The other approach is to question the very conceptual basis of these interventions for kids. What is it exactly that we're treating here? And why? If you give insulin to a kid, it's probably because the kid has diabetes. You can test for diabetes. There's an objective test that is high on specificity, meaning you're not going to have false positives. And you can know that you are giving them a life-saving intervention for an objectively diagnosable medical condition. That doesn't exist here. The basis for intervention is subjective. It's a kid's feelings. And feelings, of course, have multiple causes. They're likely to change. But more importantly than that, the modern practice of gender medicine, unlike, you know, 15, 20, 30 years ago, rests on a series of pseudoscientific claims about the human person. That sex is assigned at birth, meaning a social construct. That's not true. That all humans have an innate gender identity that they can know from very early in life infallibly, and that will never change, although somehow it's also said to be fluid. And that kids can know with absolute certainty. That's what the AAP says. No basis to believe such a thing. That is pseudoscience. That's not science. And so if you look at these young kids who are suffering on account of something, and you say, oh yeah, this boy is really a girl who was assigned the wrong sex at birth. That's a completely different conceptual framework from what existed 20, 30, 40 years ago, where transsexual was understood to be a biological man who, for whatever reason, would feel more comfortable going through life appearing as and being seen by others as a woman. Doesn't mean he really is a woman. It just means he would feel more comfortable that way.
Thank you for listening to America's Fabric. This program is paid for by approximately half commercial sponsors. The great ones, Perfection Auto Works, has been our longest. More recently, Wilkinson Wealth Management, and of course, Tucson Point and Autograph. The other half is paid for by you. And please prayerfully consider if you'd like to support this program being a sponsor. You can do so by sending a check to America's Fabric, care of KVOI Radio, 3222 South Ritchie, Tucson, Arizona, 85713. Again, America's Fabric, care of KVOI, 3222 South Ritchie, Tucson, Arizona, 85713.
The tow truck is an institution almost as old as the automobile itself. Today, tow trucks are usually flatbeds with a winch to grab your car. We call those the son of a winch. At Perfection Auto Works, our goal is to keep your car running right so that you never have to experience deliverance via a tow truck. Perfection Auto Works, 323-8650 or perfectionautoworks.com.
This is Ed Wilkinson with Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. What does it mean to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired? It means designing a plan that allows you to do the things you want to do, outpace inflation, and never run out of money in your lifetime. If you want to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired, call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911 or WilkinsonWealthMGMT.com.
At Tucson Coin and Autograph, people often ask us, how do I take care of my coins? The best way to take care of your coins is to do nothing.
and keep them in their protective holders. Cleaning a coin is harmful to its value when solvents can be abrasive to the surface. Coins are like little antiques, and originality matters. At the southeast corner of Oracle and Orange Grove, or online at TucsonCoinAutograph.com and 219-4427.
This is Herman Cain on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice.